the girls were younger. They were probably maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, somewhere in that range. And they, like often little girls do, they kind of became infatuated with horses. And it started the, "Dad, I want a horse. Dad, I want a horse," you know. And I was that was a very easy no for me to say. I was like, no, that's not like just going and buying a little fish and putting it in an aquarium and you sprinkle some food. This is almost a lifestyle change if we go down this road. And as a matter of fact, Emma kept, I think she's still mad at me today. She kept saying, "Dad, I want a horse, I want a horse." And I said, "Well, you know, maybe for Christmas, you know." And so I bought her a little figurine of a horse, put it in her stocking, and she told me sometime later that she went in a room and cried after that. So I felt really good. But anyway, so that started, "Dad, I want a horse," and all that stuff. And I said no. And then a very short time later, we had horses and had started building a barn and fencing in pastures and adopted the lifestyle that I knew would have to be adopted if we were to get horses. And then we started racing horses, taking lessons, and then we started racing horses, barrel racing. And for those of y'all that don't know what that is, that's an event in rodeos, and you run in and you run a certain pattern around certain barrels in certain positions, and whoever's the fastest wins. And it's a lot harder than it looks. I have tried it at about a quarter speed, and it is very tricky to do that. They make it look very easy. So over the past 6, 7, or 8 years, however long it's been, we went from not knowing anything about horses to knowing some things about horses and still have a lot to learn. But one of the things that I have learned about them as we ventured into that journey and the barrel racing, we'll travel to Georgia and Mississippi and different places to these barrel races, is there are, you know, a lot of your success on barrel racing depends on what horse you're on. And there are horses that you'll see that they're very stubborn. You can spend your entire life savings on a horse if you want to. And you can also find somebody that'll give you one. And sometimes all people might could afford is just a cheaper horse or something that somebody gave them, and they're just trying to do the best they can with what they have. And that horse may not really have the mind or not really be bred to be a horse that runs, and they can really resist you and everything you're trying to train them to do and teach them to do. And you may get a little bit, you know, training with them, but they really just are kind of stubborn, and they're just going to kind of do what they want to do. And you can try to get that horse to go in the gate, and if that horse doesn't want to go in the gate, he's not going. And there are he may go in that gate and start running, and you tell him to turn around the first barrel, and that horse says, "I don't want to turn around the first barrel. I want to go this way." And that's the way the horse goes. He just kind of does what he wants to do. And there are other horses that can be very nervous. And I'm getting somewhere with this. Y'all just stay with me. There are other horses that can be very nervous. You know, you take them at home and you take them or take them to the practice arena or wherever they're used to running, or there's an arena that they run at regularly, and they're fine and they're great and they're awesome. But then you take them to another place that they have never been, and all of a sudden this very awesome, well-minded, sound-minded horse sees a flag that it's never seen before, and it's the end of the world. Or they see a garbage bag over here that's flapping in the wind, or they see a cattle chute where they are doing some roping, or they see unfamiliar things to them, and the environment that they're in, it just kind of makes them go crazy. And they cannot really perform because of the environment that they're in. And then there's the type of horse that everybody wants, and that's the horse that people refer to as an automatic horse. That is a horse that is well seasoned, has, you know, they call it a been there, done that horse. They're usually a little bit older. There's not much that they have not seen, and they know exactly what they're supposed to do when they come into that arena. And a lot of times you will see, I'm talking about little bitty girls. They will go in this arena on this horse whose nostrils are flaring and its heart is pumping and there are veins popping out of this horse. It's so muscular. And those little girls are just holding on to the horn and barely holding on to the reins. And the horse does everything on its own. It'll go and it'll do exactly what it's supposed to do. And there's the rider can make some errors and it really doesn't affect the horse. They're just automatic. And, you know, that's the one that we're all jealous of. That, well, that person won because they've got the automatic horse. My horse, you got to fight. My horse, you got to give some direction. My horse, this, that, and the other. It's the automatic horse that is not affected by their environment. It's the automatic horse that is not stubborn and want to do things their own way. The automatic horse is the one that has done it correctly so many times that it's just going to do its job regardless of what's going on around it. Now, you think, well, that is about the dumbest introduction I've ever heard. But if you will stay with me, because you say, what is that? What does a horse and barrel racing have to do anything with the scriptures? Well, if you remember that Paul writes that he says, let us run the race with patience. He also writes to Timothy and says, I have finished my course. And the picture there is that there is some sort of race going on that we call life. So there is some application to what I just told you, to the things I want to talk to you about tonight. But the topic that I want to talk to you about tonight is godliness. And the verse of scripture that I want to go to start with is 2 Peter in chapter 3. And it reads this way. It says, seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation? Conversation there means your manner of life, your way of life, in all holy conversation and godliness. To have a, you know, and the definition that I would put on godliness is a reflection of God. You know, this is one of the definitions is a reverence for God, a respect for God. But in a lot of times, the application you see there is just, it is a reflection of God. The way somebody talks or handles, or the way you think, or the way you handle some things, if it is done in a way that the Lord instructed us to do that, then you could say that in that instance, we are to some degree a reflection of God, and that's godliness. Now, the Bible tells us a lot about godliness. It tells us that we are to live our life in all godliness. It tells us that we are to exercise ourselves unto godliness. It tells us that we are to follow after godliness. And it tells us that we're to add to our knowledge and our temperance and those things, that we're to add godliness to it. So one of our goals as you run the race of life should be to be ever increasingly adding godliness to your life. You should be following and pursuing and exercising things that make you a better picture and a better reflection of God. So, if somebody comes up to you and they are argumentative and they're angry and you go right back at them with the same venom that they're bringing back at you, you are not being a reflection of God. Because what does the Bible say about when he was reviled, he reviled not? Okay, so the person that is, you know, maybe somebody is being very angry with them, and that person that is getting the brunt of that is humble and quiet and meek. Now you're starting to look a lot more like the Lord. So your godliness would have increased right there. So I want to talk to you about godliness tonight, and what in the world did I talk about horses at the beginning for? The reason I wanted to bring up that example of those different types of horses is because to me, it relates very well to godliness. There are people that, and I have been like this, there are people that are like, when it comes to godliness, they are like the horse that no matter what the rider is instructing and telling that horse to do, they're just going to do kind of what they want to do. They're not that concerned with what godliness is. They're not really concerned too much with the way the Lord would do things. They're more concerned with doing things the way they want to do them. They remind me a lot of that first horse. But then the horse that does really well when it's in the right environment, that reminds me a lot of a person that approaches godliness this way. That as long as I'm in church and as long as I'm around my godly friends and godly things, I am a pretty good reflection of the Lord. But if you take me out of that environment and you put me around an ungodly crowd, you put me in ungodly situations, you put me around people or things that are not concerned with the Lord, then all of a sudden, I'm not quite as focused on godliness as I would be were I in the better environments. That's a lot like the horse, that its environment has a lot to do with how focused it is. Or are you like the horse when it comes to godliness, that regardless of what your circumstances or your environment or your mood is or what company you're in the midst of, are you like the horse that is automatic and is just going to do what it's supposed to do no matter what is going on around it, no matter how it feels? Is your focus on godliness as intent as the horse who we would consider to be automatic? Now, that's something to think about. I want to look at some examples here in the Bible of some people that in a lot of ways relate to these different types of horses. And ask yourself, am I like this person or am I like that person? When I think about wavering godliness, when I think about people that their godliness and their focus on godliness is affected by the company they keep, meaning that as long as I'm around Brother Tim, our godliness is, boy, it's number one for me. But when I'm around Brother not Tim, now I'm not all that worried about it. Are you with me? As long as I'm around these people over here, I'm really not all that focused on godliness. When I think of that, the first person that came to my mind was Aaron in the Old Testament. And you can read about him in Genesis, the 32nd chapter, I believe it is. And there's not a particular verse over there that I want to look at, but that's where the account is. I said Genesis, I meant Exodus, I'm so sorry. Exodus, the 32nd chapter. If you think about Aaron, who was with Moses, and the things that Aaron saw, you know, Aaron's rod is the rod that budded. Aaron's rod is the rod that was placed in the Ark of the Covenant. And Aaron saw the deliverance from Egypt. Aaron saw all of those miracles. Aaron was there in the midst of all of those plagues. Aaron was there, you know, when the water came from the rock. He was there when the Red Sea was parted. You know, Aaron has had a front row seat to the power of God. And I would think that that would strengthen your godliness or your desire to be like God. Certainly, if the skies parted right now and we looked up and we were able to have a glimpse of heaven and to see our loved ones and to see Christ and to see the angels standing there and all praising God, I would like to think when I woke up tomorrow, I would be a little more focused on godliness than anything else. Well, Aaron has got a front row seat to some amazing things, right? And so when Moses goes up onto the mount to receive the law, as impatient, fleshy people can be, the people of Israel are tired of waiting on him to come back. And again, I go back to this. If you've seen all these things, are you really going to put a time limit on when we kind of need to go to the next step? But these people grow very impatient very quickly, and they say, hey, I don't guess he's coming back. And so Aaron is standing there, and they begin to talk to Aaron about this and say, you know, he's not coming back. And this is what it says. It says, and when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him. Now, wouldn't it be a good time for Aaron to say, hold up. Do you not remember Egypt? Do you not remember the pillar of the cloud? Do you not remember the pillar of fire? Do you not remember the Red Sea and watching it swallow up Pharaoh and his armies? Do you not remember the water from the rock? Do you not remember the manna from heaven? Do you not remember those things? Be patient. It's like the Bible says, be still. Be patient and just wait on the Lord. But they go to Aaron, and all of a sudden this congregation that has been the beneficiaries of God's mercy and God's plan, all of a sudden they begin to turn on the Lord. And I hope that the Lord, for some reason, just did not inspire somebody to write something between verse 1 and verse 2 of Exodus, the 32nd chapter. I hope there was something else that transpired in there that maybe would make me be a little more understanding of what Aaron is doing. But it goes from, we don't know what happened to Moses, up and make us gods. And the very next verse it says, and Aaron said unto them, break off the golden earrings which are in your ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters, and bring them unto me. And it says, the people broke them off, and he took them, he received them, he fashioned it with a graving tool, and he made it into a molten calf. And they said, these be our gods. You talking about a man that threw godliness out the window like that? To me, this is a man whose focus on godliness was very much dependent upon the company that he kept. Now, that is a stark warning to you young people. I would venture to say, if I had the ability to line up 1,000 people whose lives started out on the right path but went shipwrecked, I would dare to say almost every single one of them, if they were honest and would admit it, would say it all started when I was hanging with the wrong people. Godliness, our focus on godliness, can be affected by the company that we keep. And Aaron's most certainly was. And if you read on in there, but on later in this chapter, 32 or 33, when Moses confronts Aaron, it's funny how he does this. He says his response to Moses, and he's like, well, hey, Moses is like, what have you done? He's like, hey, this is on them. They were demanding. It's almost like he was afraid for his life. And he said, now the Bible told us that he took a graving tool and made a molten calf. But he tells Moses, oh, we just put the gold in there and a calf came out. Like you just, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what happened, but it's just calf. Yeah, well, what about the part where you fashioned it into it, Aaron? You see, the company that Aaron kept affected his focus on the godliness. Now, what about in Jonah, the 4th chapter? You read about a man named Jonah here that most of the time we focus on the beginning of Jonah and the whale and all that stuff. But this is after all that. This is after Jonah has repented. This is after the whale. This is after his interactions and his rebuke from the Lord. This is after he has experienced the Lord's mercy and the whale vomiting him up back on dry land, and him going into Nineveh and preaching into Nineveh and seeing one of the greatest revivals that's ever recorded in the Bible. This is after all of that. He is a man that is focused on godliness. Until what? Until he gets in a bad mood. I mean, really, that's just the nuts and bolts of it. Jonah gets in a bad mood because he gets upset that the Lord did not destroy Nineveh. And so he goes over and he begins to sit and pout about the Lord not destroying Nineveh like he said he was going to destroy it. And so all of a sudden, Jonah's focus on being very godlike, which is what? To being merciful to those that are repentant. The Lord sends the gourd to him, and the gourd grows up over, and he finds a place to get up under it, and there's some shade there. And the next day, the Lord dries it up, and Jonah weeps and wails about it because, oh, the gourd is dried up, and I'm so sad. And the Lord says to him, you're more concerned about the gourd being destroyed than you are Nineveh. He says, you're begging me for this plant to have my mercy, but you don't want me to be merciful to all these people. When he says, I've got over, I believe it was 600,000 children in this city. It says they don't even know their right hand from their left. That's either children or that's people that are mentally challenged. And Jonah doesn't care about them. And he gets in a bad mood, and very quickly, his focus on being godlike is gone. Aaron's circumstances took it away from him. Jonah's mood took it away from him. What about Adam? What took Adam's godliness away from him that you read in the book of Genesis? Was it not his desire? His desire when he heard the lie that if you eat of these things, then you will be like gods? And what was his desire? Obviously, Eve's desire, Adam's desire, was to be like gods. And so Adam, his desire takes him away from his godly thinking. Also think about this man. We've talked about Aaron's circumstances. We've talked about Jonah's mood. We've talked about Adam's desire. Listen to this guy right here. There's a whole lot of wisdom in these few verses in Proverbs, the 30th chapter, in verse 8. Let me do verse 7. Two things have I required of thee, deny me them not before I die. He says, remove me far from vanity and lies. Now notice this. He says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. That's a wise person right there. When was the last time you heard somebody say, your boss comes in and says, hey, well, you know, what kind of salary are you looking to make? You know, I can give you $500,000 a year, or I can give you $50,000 a year. When was the last time somebody said, just give me somewhere that's just enough? I said, well, I'll take the 500. But this man says this. He knows that his focus on godliness will absolutely be affected by his circumstances. And he says, I don't want to go down those roads. He says, listen, if you give me too much, if I've got too many blessings, he's wise enough to realize the circumstances and the situations that will be created by me having excess will take my focus off godliness, because I'll end up saying, who is the Lord? But then on the other end, he says, but don't give me too little. Because if you give me too little, then I'm going to be in a place where I'm in poverty and I'm going to steal, which is against the Lord. And so he says, I realize, Lord, that my circumstances that surround me and my situation directly affect my desire and focus for godliness. So, Lord, please keep me where I need to be and where I can handle the things that I have. That's a very wise man. Think about Peter. Peter was very focused on godliness, right? Until when? Until fear set in. Until they took the Lord until they were beating him, until Peter thought, they're about to associate me with the Lord, and I better deny him lest I get some of the action that he's getting. And so the next thing you know, godliness and being godlike is not that important to Peter. Do you know how many teenagers fall victim to that? How many teenagers realize that if I stand with the Lord, they're going to possibly tear me to shreds like they tear the Lord to shreds? So I better not associate myself with him. You know how many teenagers fall victim to that? You need to pray, and I need to pray more, that God will raise up courageous, brave, godly young people that are willing to go into the furnace of fire for the sake of the Lord and have the faith that he will be there with them, and if not, he'll take them home to heaven. We need more of those. So Aaron, the company that he kept affected his focus on godliness. Jonah's mood affected his focus on godliness. Adam's desire, Peter's fear, the man in Proverbs' circumstances. But now let me leave you with this. If you flip over to 2 Corinthians, we read here about Paul. Paul had ample opportunities to lose focus on his godliness and his desire to be a reflection of God. He says, of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. That's 195 stripes. Peter was afraid of those stripes, and so he denied Christ. Paul said, I took the stripes. And he even says, I bear in my body the marks of Jesus. What's he talking about? One of the things he's talking about is what 195 scars across your back would look like. Why were those things there? Not because he stole a loaf of bread, because he loved the Lord and followed and served and preached about him. 195 stripes did not break his focus. This is the automatic horse. This is the horse that no matter what's going on around him, it's focused and it's doing its job and it's running its race. He says, thrice was I beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Stoned so much, if you're reading the Bible, that they thought he was dead. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeyings often. In perils of water. In perils of robbers, in perils by mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Did Paul have anything going on in his life that could potentially break his focus off of the Lord and take it away from godliness? I think that's a pretty exhaustive list, don't you? It's a list a whole lot more intense than any of us could write. And then he goes on and adds to it. And he says, I was given a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan. And he says, for this thing I besought the Lord thrice that it might depart from me. Jonah's mood affected him. Have you ever met somebody, and maybe some of you have dealt with it, somebody that's just in chronic pain and there's really nothing that can be done for them, and it's just a constant 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nagging chronic pain that they have to deal with? It is exhausting. Talk to some of those people. Your heart breaks for them because there's no escape. That's Paul. Paul saying, I have begged that the Lord would take this from me. The Lord said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And then Paul says this. Paul doesn't say, he won't take it from me. But I'm in such a cotton-picking bad mood because of this thorn that I've got that I just am pouting and I'm stomping and I'm mad and I'm irritable with everybody. And my mood has taken my focus off being a reflection of God. Paul doesn't say that. He says, most gladly, not begrudgingly, most gladly, therefore will I rather glory in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. That is the automatic horse that says, I have got all of these reasons to panic, all of these reasons to be afraid, all of this company that is distracting me, all of this, these circumstances that have just come up around me. I've got every reason in the world to quit worrying about being a reflection of God and to just go off and do something different. He says, but I will not do that. He says, I will gladly, for Christ's sake, take pleasure in the road that I'm traveling of godliness. Now, where does that leave us for tonight? He talks in Hebrews about running the race with patience. He talks about finishing his course. Look, my godliness and my desire to focus on that, look, it can go out the window in a millisecond if the right situation presents itself. And sometimes that right situation, just humor me here and pity me, that right situation could be a bad call from a little league umpire. Are you with me? And my godliness is not that important to me anymore. I've had to go apologize to a few of them before. And I sit there and I think to myself, what is wrong with you? How in the world can you stand up and preach before God's people and pour out the things of God and go to the Lord in prayer and embrace Him as your Savior and look forward to the day that you see His face and let a bad call in a little league ball game tear you away from that just like that? Luke, you are pathetic. I look in my mirror and I tell myself that. Why? Why am I like that? One, because I'm fallen. I think about what Paul said, who shall deliver me from this body of death? I thank God for my Savior, Jesus Christ. As we depart from here tonight and we go about the rest of our week and all the days of your life, the devil will throw company at you. He will throw things that change your mood. He will throw desires into your heart. He will change your circumstances. He will instill you with fear. Also, he can, all because and all to, try to make you less a picture and reflection of the God he hates. But our job is to be like Paul, and in all of those perils, in all of those struggles, in all of those stripes, to be so focused on the Lord that none of those things can take you away from your walk of godliness. And we may, at the end of our days, we may bear in our body the marks of Jesus Christ. But in my mind and in my imagination, I think there were probably times that Paul reached back and rubbed his fingers over those, what you know were raised, nasty scars, and he probably smiled. And a tear probably fell down his cheek because he knew they couldn't break me from wanting to be like my Lord. I hope that that's been profitable for you tonight. And please pray for all of us that we can finish our course walking in godliness.